visitors on the way to the stake, I said, shaking my head. Nevertheless, he understood the power of desire. I looked sharply at the vampire. Desire urges me on as fear bridles me. Did Bruno feature in your essay for All Souls? A bit. Matthew's mouth flattened into a hard line. Will you please come away from there? We can talk about philosophy another time. Other passages drifted through my mind. There was something else about Bruno's work that might make Matthew think of him. He wrote about the goddess Diana. I stepped away from the stall. Balthazar isn't a pony, Matthew warned, pulling my elbow. I can see that, but I could handle that horse. Both the alchemical manuscript and the Italian philosopher vanished from my mind at the thought of such a challenge. You don't ride as well, Matthew asked in disbelief. I grew up in the country and have ridden since I was a child, dressage, jumping, everything. Being on a horse was even more like flying than rowing was. We have other horses. Balthazar stays where he is, he said firmly. Riding was an unforeseen bonus of coming to France, one that almost made Isabeau's cold presence bearable. Matthew led me to the other end of the stables, where six more fine animals waited. Two of them were big and black, although not as large as Balthazar, one a fairly round chestnut mare, another a bay gelding. There were two gray Andalusians as well, with large feet and curved necks. One came to the door to see what was going on in her domain. This is Na Rakasa, he said, gently rubbing her muzzle. Her name means fire dancer. We usually just call her Rakasa. She moves beautifully, but she's willful. You two should get along famously. I refused to take the bait, though it was charmingly offered, and let Rakasa sniff at my hair and face. What's her sister's name? Fidat. Silva. Fidat came forward when Matthew said her name, her dark eyes affectionate. Fidat is Isabeau's horse, and Rakasa is her sister. Matthew pointed to the two blacks. Those are mine, Dar and Sayad. What do their names mean, I asked, walking to their stalls. Dar is Arabic for time, and Sayad means hunter, Matthew explained, joining me. Sayad loves riding across the fields chasing game and jumping hedges. Dar is patient and steady. We continued the tour, Matthew pointing out the features of the mountains and orienting me to the town. He showed me where the chateau had been modified and how restorers had used a different kind of stone because the original was no longer available. By the time we were finished, I wasn't likely to get lost, in part due to the central keep, which was hard to misplace. Why am I so tired? I yawned as we returned to the chateau. You're hopeless, Matthew said in exasperation. Do you really need me to recount the events of the past 36 hours? At his urging, I agreed to another nap. Leaving him in the study, I climbed the stairs and flung myself into bed, too tired to even blow out the candles. Moments later, I was dreaming of riding through a dark forest, a loose green tunic belted around my waist. There were sandals tied onto my feet, their leather fastenings crossed around my ankles and calves. Dogs bayed and hooves crashed in the underbrush behind me. A quiver of arrows nestled against my shoulder, and in one fist I held a bow. Despite the ominous sounds of my pursuers, I felt no fear. In my dream I smiled, with the knowledge I could outrun those who hunted me. Fly, I commanded, and the horse did. Chapter 19. The next morning, my first thoughts were also of riding. I ran a brush through my hair, rinsed my mouth out, and threw on a close-fitting pair of black leggings. They were the nearest thing to riding breeches that I had with me. Running shoes would make it impossible to keep my heels down in the stirrups, so on went my loafers instead. Not exactly proper footwear, but they'd do. A long-sleeved t-shirt and a fleece pullover completed my ensemble. Dragging my hair back into a ponytail, I returned to the bedroom. Matthew lifted his eyebrow as I rocketed into the room, his arm barring me from going any farther. He was leaning against a wide archway that led to the stairs, well-groomed as always, wearing dark gray breeches and a black sweater. "Let's ride in the afternoon." I'd been expecting this. Dinner with Isabeau had been tense at best, and afterward my sleep had been punctuated with nightmares. Matthew had climbed the stairs to check on me several times. "I'm fine. Exercise and fresh air will be the best thing in the world for me." When I tried to get past him again, he stopped me with only a dark look. "If you so much as sway in the saddle, I'm bringing you home. Understood?" "Understood." Downstairs, I headed for the dining room, but Matthew pulled me in the other direction. "Let's eat in the kitchens," he said quietly. No formal breakfast with Isabeau staring at me over Le Monde. That was welcome news. We ate in what were ostensibly the housekeeper's rooms, in front of a blazing fire at a table set for two, though I would be the only one eating Mart's excellent, abundant food. A huge pot of tea sat on the scarred, round wooden table, wrapped in a linen towel to keep it hot. Mart glanced at me with concern, tutting at my dark circles and pale skin. When my fork slowed, Matthew reached for a pyramid of boxes crowned with a black velvet-covered helmet. "For you," he said, putting them on the table. The helmet was self-explanatory. It was shaped like a high-crowned baseball hat, with a fold of black grosgrain ribbon at the nape. Despite its velvet covering and ribbon, the helmet was sturdy and made expressly to keep soft human skulls from cracking if they met with the ground. I hated them, but it was a wise precaution. "Thank you," I said. "What's in the boxes?" "Open them and see." The first box held a pair of black breeches with suede patches inside the knees to grip the saddle. They would be far more pleasant to ride in than my thin, slippery leggings, and looked like they would fit, too. Matthew must have been making more phone calls and relaying approximate measurements while I napped. I smiled at him in gratitude. The box also held a black padded vest with a long tail and stiff metal supports sewn into the seams. It looked and would no doubt feel like a turtle shell, uncomfortable and unwieldy. "This isn't necessary." I held it up, frowning.
"It is if you're going riding."
His voice didn't show the slightest hint of emotion. "You tell me you're experienced. If so, you won't have a problem adjusting to its weight." My color rose, and my fingertips gave a warning tingle. Matthew watched me with interest, and Mart came to the door and gave a sniff. I breathed in and out until the tingling stopped.
"You wear a seatbelt in my car," Matthew said evenly. "You'll wear a vest on my horse."
We stared at each other in a standoff of wills. The thought of the fresh air defeated me, and Mart's eyes glittered with amusement. No doubt our negotiations were as much fun to watch as were the volleys between Matthew and Isabeau. I pulled the final box toward me in silent concession. It was long and heavy, and there was a sharp tang of leather when the lid lifted. Boots. Knee-length, black boots. I'd never shown horses and had limited resources, so I'd never owned a proper pair of riding boots. These were beautiful, with their curved calves and supple leather. My fingers touched their shining surfaces. "Thank you," I breathed, delighted with his surprise.
"I'm pretty sure they'll fit," Matthew said, his eyes soft.
"Come, girl," Mart said cheerfully from the door. "You change."
She barely got me into the laundry room before I'd kicked off my loafers and peeled the leggings from my body. She took the worn lycra and cotton from me while I wriggled into the breeches.
"There was a time when women didn't ride like men," Mart said, looking at the muscles in my legs and shaking her head.
Matthew was on his phone when I returned, sending out instructions to all the other people in his world who required his management. He looked up with approval.
"Those will be more comfortable."
He stood and picked up the boots.
"There's no jack in here. You'll have to wear your other shoes to the stables."
"No, I want to put them on now," I said, fingers outstretched.
"Sit down, then."
He shook his head at my impatience.
You'll never get them on the first time without help. Matthew picked up my chair with me in it and turned it so he had more room to maneuver. He held out the right boot, and I stuck my foot in as far as the ankle. He was right. No amount of tugging was going to get my foot around the stiff bend. He stood over my foot, grasping the heel and toe of the boot and wriggling it gently as I pulled the leather in the other direction. After several minutes of struggle, my foot worked its way into the shank. Matthew gave the sole a final firm push, and the boot snuggled against my bones. Once both boots were on, I held my legs out to admire. Matthew tugged and patted, sliding his cold fingers around the top rim to make sure my blood could circulate. I stood, my legs feeling unusually long, took a few stiff-ankled steps, and did a little twirl. "Thank you." I threw my arms around his neck, the toes of my boots grazing the floor. I love them. Matthew carried my vest and hat to the stables, much as he had carried my computer and yoga mat in Oxford. The stable doors were flung open, and there were sounds of activity. "George?" Matthew called. A small, wiry man of indeterminate age, though not a vampire, came around the corner, carrying a bridle and a curry comb. When we passed Balthazar's stall, the stallion stomped angrily and tossed his head. "You promised," he seemed to say. Inside my pocket was a tiny apple that I'd wheedled from Mart. "Here you go, baby," I said, holding it out on a flat palm. Matthew watched warily as Balthazar extended his neck and reached with delicate lips to pick the fruit from my hand. Once it was in his mouth, he looked at his owner triumphantly. "Yes, I see that you're behaving like a prince," Matthew said dryly, "but that doesn't mean you won't behave like a devil at the first opportunity." Balthazar's hooves struck the ground in annoyance. We passed by the tack room. In addition to the regular saddles, bridles, and reins, there were freestanding wooden frames that held something like a small armchair with odd supports on one side. "What are they?" "Side saddles," Matthew said, kicking off his shoes and stepping into a tall pair of well-worn boots. His foot slid down easily with a simple stamp on the heel and a tug at the top. "Isabeau prefers them." In the paddock, Dar and Rakasa turned their heads and looked with interest while George and Matthew began a detailed discussion of all the natural obstacles we might encounter. I held my palm out to Dar, sorry that there were no more apples in my pocket. The gelding looked disappointed, too, once he picked up the sweet scent. "Next time," I promised. Ducking under his neck, I arrived at Rakasa's side. "Hello, beauty." Rakasa picked up her right front foot and cocked her head toward me. I ran my hands over her neck and shoulders, getting her used to my scent and touch, and gave the saddle a tug, checking the tightness of the girth strap, making sure the blanket underneath was smooth. She reached around and gave me an inquiring smell and a snuffle, nosing at my pullover where the apple had been. She tossed her head in indignation. "You too," I promised her with a laugh, placing my left hand firmly on her rump. "Let's have a look." Horses like having their feet touched about as much as most witches like being dunked in water, which is to say, not much. But, out of habit and superstition, I'd never ridden a horse without first checking to make sure that nothing was lodged in their soft hooves. When I straightened, the two men were watching me closely. George said something to indicate I would do. Matthew nodded thoughtfully, holding out my vest and hat. The vest was snug and hard, but it wasn't as bad as I'd expected. The hat interfered with my ponytail, and I slid the elastic band lower to accommodate it before snapping the chin band together. Matthew was at my back in the time it took me to grab the reins and lift my foot to Rakasa's stirrup. "Will you never wait until I help you?" he growled into my ear. "I can get onto a horse myself," I said hotly. "But you don't need to." Matthew's hands cupped my shin, lifting me effortlessly into the saddle. After that, he checked my stirrup length, rechecked the girth strap, and finally went to his own horse. He swung into the saddle with the practiced air that suggested he'd been on horseback for hundreds of years. Once there, he looked like a king. Rakasa started to dance in impatience, and I pushed my heels down. She stopped, looking puzzled. "Quiet," I whispered. She nodded her head and stared forward, her ears working back and forth. "Take her around the paddock while I check my saddle," Matthew said casually, swinging his left knee onto Dar's shoulder and fiddling with his stirrup leather. My eyes narrowed. His stirrups needed no adjustment. He was checking out my riding skills. I walked Rikasa halfway around the paddock to feel her gait. The Andalusian really did dance, delicately picking up her feet and putting them down firmly in a beautiful rocking movement. When I pressed both heels into her sides, Rikasa's dancing walk turned into an equally rollicking smooth trot. We passed Matthew, who had given up all pretense of adjusting his saddle. George leaned against the fence, smiling broadly. "Beautiful girl," I breathed silently. Her left ear shot back, and she picked up the pace slightly. My calf pressed into her flank, just behind the stirrup, and she broke into a canter, her feet reaching out into the air and her neck arched. How angry would Matthew be if we jumped the paddock fence? Angry, I was sure. Rikasa rounded the corner, and I slowed her to a trot. "Well?" I demanded. George nodded and opened the paddock gate. "You have a good seat," Matthew said, eyeing my backside. "Good hands, too. You'll be all right. By the way," he continued in a conversational tone, leaning toward me and dropping his voice, "if you'd jumped the fence back there, today's outing would have been over." Once we'd cleared the gardens and passed through the old gate, the trees thickened and Matthew scanned the forest. A few feet into the woods, he began to relax, having accounted for every creature within and discovered that none of them were of the two-legged variety. Matthew kicked Dar into a trot, and Rikasa obediently waited for me to kick her as well. I did, amazed all over again at how smoothly she moved. "What kind of horse is Dar?" I asked, noticing his equally smooth gait. "I suppose you'd call him a Destria," Matthew explained. That was the mount that carried knights to the Crusades. He was bred for speed and agility. "I thought Destriers were enormous war horses." Dar was bigger than Rikasa, but not much. "They were large for the time, but they weren't big enough to carry any of the men in this family into battle. Not once we had armor on our backs and weapons. We trained on horses like Dar and rode them for pleasure, but we fought on Percherons like Balthazar." I stared between Rikasa's ears, working up the courage to broach another subject. "May I ask you something about your mother?" "Of course," Matthew said, twisting in his saddle. He put one fist on his hips and held his horse's reins lightly in the other hand. I now knew with absolute certainty how a medieval knight looked on horseback. "Why does she hate witches so much?" "Vampires and witches are traditional enemies, but Isabeau's dislike of me goes beyond that. It seems personal." "I suppose you want a better answer than you smell like spring?" "Yes, I want the real reason." "She's jealous." Matthew patted Dar's shoulder. "What on earth is she jealous of?" "Let's see. Your power, especially a witch's ability to see the future. Your ability to bear children and pass that power to a new generation. And the ease with which you die, I suppose," he said, his voice reflective. "Isabeau had you and Louisa for children." "Yes, Isabeau made both of us, but it's not quite the same as bearing a child, I think." "Why does she envy a witch's second sight?" "That has to do with how Isabeau was made. Her maker didn't ask permission first." Matthew's face darkened. He wanted her for a wife, and he just took her and turned her into a vampire. She had a reputation as a seer, and was young enough to still hope for children. When she became a vampire, both of those abilities were gone. She's never quite gotten over it, and witches are a constant reminder of the life she's lost. "Why does she envy that witches die so easily?" "Because she misses my father." He abruptly stopped talking, and it was clear I'd pressed him enough. The trees thinned, and Rikasa's ears shot back and forth impatiently. Go ahead, he said with resignation, gesturing at the open field before us. Rakasa leaped forward at the touch of my heels, catching the bit in her teeth. She slowed climbing the hill, and once on the crest she pranced and tossed her head, clearly enjoying the fact that Dar was standing at the bottom while she was on top. I circled her into a fast figure eight, changing her leads on the fly to keep her from stumbling as she went around corners. Dar took off, not at a canter but a gallop, his black tail streaming out behind him and his hooves striking the earth with unbelievable speed. I gasped and pulled lightly on Rakasa's reins to make her stop. So that was the point of destriers. They could go from 0 to 60 like a finely tuned sports car. Matthew made no effort to slow his horse as he approached, but Dar stopped on a dime about 6 feet away from us, his sides bowed out slightly with exertion. Show off! You won't let me jump a fence and you put on that display? I teased. Dar doesn't get enough exercise either. This is exactly what he needs. Matthew grinned and patted his horse on the shoulder. Are you interested in a race? We'll give you a head start, of course, he said with a courtly bow. You're on. Where to? Matthew pointed to a solitary tree on the top of the ridge and watched me, alert for the first indication of movement. He'd picked something that you could shoot past without running into anything. Maybe Rakasa wasn't as good at abrupt stops as Dar was. There was no way I was going to surprise a vampire, and no way my horse, for all her smooth gait, was going to beat Dar up the ridge. Still, I was eager to see how well she would perform. I leaned forward and patted Rakasa on the neck, resting my chin for just a moment on her warm flesh and closing my eyes. Fly, I encouraged her silently. Rakasa shot forward as if she'd been slapped on the rump, and my instincts took over. I lifted myself out of the saddle to make it easier for her to carry my weight, tying a loose knot in the reins. When her speed stabilized, I lowered myself into the saddle, clutching her warm body between my legs. My feet kicked free from the unnecessary stirrups, and my fingers wove through her mane. Matthew and Dar thundered behind us. It was like my dream, the one where dogs and horses were chasing me. My left hand curled as if holding something, and I bent low along Rakasa's neck, eyes closed. Fly, I repeated, but the voice in my head no longer sounded like my own. Rakasa responded with still more speed. I felt the tree grow closer. Matthew swore an oxyton and Rakasa swerved to the left at the last minute, slowing to a canter and then a trot. There was a tug on her reins. My eyes shot open in alarm. Do you always ride unfamiliar horses at top speed, with your eyes closed, no reins and no stirrups? Matthew's voice was coldly furious. You row with your eyes closed, I've seen you. And you walk with them closed, too. I've always suspected that magic was involved. And you must use your power to ride as well, otherwise you'd be dead. And for what it's worth, I believe you're telling Rakasa what to do with your mind and not with your hands and legs. I wondered if what he said was true. Matthew made an impatient sound and dismounted by swinging his right leg high over Dar's head, kicking his left foot out of the stirrup, and sliding down the horse's side facing front. Get down from there, he said roughly, grabbing Rakasa's loose reins. Dismounting the traditional way, I swung my right leg over Rakasa's rump. When my back was to him, Matthew reached up and scooped me off the horse. Now I knew why he preferred to face front. It kept you from being grabbed from behind and hauled off your mount. He turned me around and crushed me to his chest. Dieu, he whispered into my hair. Don't do anything like that again, please. You told me not to worry about what I was doing. It's why you brought me to France, I said, confused by his reaction. I'm sorry, he said earnestly. I'm trying not to interfere. But it's difficult to watch you using powers you don't understand, especially when you're not aware you're doing it. Matthew left me to tend to the horses, tying their reins so that they wouldn't step on them, but giving them the freedom to nibble the sparse fall grass. When he returned, his face was somber. There's something I need to show you. He led me to the tree and we sat underneath it. I folded my legs carefully to the side so that my boots didn't cut into my legs. Matthew simply dropped, his knees on the ground and his feet curled under his thighs. He reached into the pocket of his breeches and drew out a piece of paper with black and gray bars on a white background. It had been folded and refolded several times. It was a DNA report. Mine?
Yours.
When?
My fingers traced the bars along the page. Marcus brought the results to New College. I didn't want to share them with you so soon after you were reminded of your parents' death.
He hesitated. Was I right to wait?
When I nodded, Matthew looked relieved.
What does it say? I asked.
We don't understand everything, he replied slowly. But Marcus and Miriam did identify markers in your DNA that we've seen before.
Miriam's tiny, precise handwriting marched down the left side of the page, and the bars, some circled with red pen, marched down the right.
This is the genetic marker for precognition, Matthew continued, pointing to the first circled smudge.
His finger began slowly moving down the page.
This one is for flight. This helps witches find things that are lost.
Matthew kept reeling off powers and abilities one at a time until my head spun.
This one is for talking with the dead. This is for transmogrification. This is telekinesis. This is spell casting. This one is charms. This one is curses. And you've got mind reading, telepathy, and empathy, the next to one another.
This can't be right. I'd never heard of a witch with more than one or two powers. Matthew had already reached a dozen.
I think the findings are right, Diana.
These powers may never manifest, but you've inherited the genetic predisposition for them.
He flipped the page. There were more red circles and more careful annotations by Miriam. Here are the elemental markers. Earth is present in almost all witches, and some have either earth and air or earth and water. You've got all three, which we've never seen before. And you've also got fire. Fire is very, very rare.
Matthew pointed to the four smudges.
What are elemental markers?
My feet were feeling uncomfortably breezy and my fingers were tingling.
Indications that you had the genetic predisposition to control one or more of the elements. They explain why you could raise a witch wind. Based on this, you could command witch fire and what's called witch water as well.
What does earth do?
Herbal magic. The power to affect growing things, the basics. Combined with spell casting, cursing, and charms, or any one of them really, it means you have not only powerful magical abilities, but an innate talent for witchcraft.
My aunt was good with spells. Emily wasn't, but could fly for short distances and see the future. These were classic differences among witches. Dividing those who used witchcraft, like Sarah, from those who used magic. It all boiled down to whether words shaped your power or whether you just had it and could wield it as you liked. I buried my face in my hands. The prospect of seeing the future as my mother could had been scary enough. Control of the elements? Talking with the dead?
There is a long list of powers on that sheet. We've only seen, what, four or five of them?
It was terrifying.
I suspect we've seen more than that. Like the way you move with your eyes closed, your ability to communicate with Rakasa, and your sparkly fingers. We just don't have names for them yet.
Please tell me that's all.
Matthew hesitated. Not quite.
He flipped to another page.
We can't yet identify these markers. In most cases, we have to correlate accounts of a witch's activities, some of them centuries old, with DNA evidence. It can be hard to match them up.
Do the tests explain why my magic is emerging now?
We don't need a test for that. Your magic is behaving as if it's waking after a long sleep. All that inactivity has made it restless, and now it wants to have its way.
Blood will out, Matthew said lightly. He rocked gracefully to his feet and lifted me up.
You'll catch cold sitting on the ground, and I'll have a hell of a time explaining myself to Mart if you get sick.
He whistled to the horses. They strolled in our direction, still munching on their unexpected treat. We rode for another hour, exploring the woods and fields around Settur. Matthew pointed out the best place to hunt rabbits, and where his father had taught him to shoot a crossbow without taking out his own eye. When we turned back to the stables, my worries over the test results had been replaced with a pleasant feeling of exhaustion. "My muscles will be sore tomorrow," I said, groaning. "I haven't been on a horse for years." "Nobody would have guessed that from the way you rode today," he said. We passed out of the forest and entered the chateau's stone gate. "You're a good rider, Diana, but you mustn't go out by yourself. It's too easy to lose your way." Matthew wasn't worried I'd get lost. He was worried I'd be found. "I won't." His long fingers relaxed on the reins. He'd been clutching them for the past 5 minutes. This vampire was used to giving orders that were obeyed instantly. He wasn't accustomed to making requests and negotiating agreements. And his usual quick temper was nowhere in evidence. Sidling Rakasa closer to Dar, I reached over and raised Matthew's palm to my mouth. My lips were warm against his hard, cold flesh. His pupils dilated in surprise. I let go, and, clucking Rakasa forward, headed into the stables. Chapter 20. Isabeau was mercifully absent at lunch. Afterward, I wanted to go straight to Matthew's study and start examining Aurora Consurgents, but he convinced me to take a bath first. It would, he promised, make the inevitable muscle stiffness more bearable. Halfway upstairs, I had to stop and rub a cramp in my leg. I was going to pay for the morning's enthusiasm. The bath was heavenly, long, hot, and relaxing. I put on loose black trousers, a sweater, and a pair of socks and padded downstairs, where a fire was blazing. My flesh turned orange and red as I held my hands out to the flames. What would it be like to control fire? My fingers tingled in response to the question, and I slid them safely into my pockets. Matthew looked up from his desk. "Your manuscript is next to your computer." Its black covers drew me as surely as a magnet. I sat down at the table and opened them, holding the book carefully. The colors were even brighter than I remembered. After staring at the queen for several minutes, I turned to the first page. "Incipit Tractatus Aurora Consurgents Initialatus." The words were familiar. Here begins the treatise, called The Rising of the Dawn. But I still felt the shiver of pleasure associated with seeing a manuscript for the first time. "Everything good comes to me along with her. She is known as the Wisdom of the South, who calls it out in the streets and to the multitudes." I read silently, translating from the Latin. It was a beautiful work, full of paraphrases from scripture as well as other texts. "Do you have a Bible up here?" It would be wise for me to have one handy as I made my way through the manuscript. "Yes, but I'm not sure where it is. Do you want me to look for it?" Matthew rose slightly from his chair, but his eyes were still glued to his computer screen. "No, I'll find it." I got up and ran my finger down the edge of the nearest shelf. Matthew's books were arranged not by size, but in a running timeline. Those on the first bookshelf were so ancient that I couldn't bear to think about what they contained. The lost works of Aristotle, perhaps? Anything was possible. Roughly half of Matthew's books were shelved spine in to protect the book's fragile edges. Many of these had identifying marks written along the edges of the pages, and thick black letters spelled out a title here, an author's name there. Halfway around the room, the books began to appear spine out, their titles and authors embossed in gold and silver. I slid past the manuscripts with their thick and bumpy pages, some with small Greek letters on the front edge. I kept going, looking for a large, fat, printed book. My index finger froze in front of one bound in brown leather and covered with gilding. "Matthew, please tell me Biblia Sacra 1450 is not what I think it is." "Okay, it's not what you think it is," he said automatically, fingers racing over the keys with more than human speed. He was paying little attention to what I was doing, and none at all to what I was saying. Leaving Gutenberg's Bible where it was, I continued along the shelves, hoping that it wasn't the only one available to me. My finger froze again at a book labeled Will's Plays. Were these books given to you by friends? Most of them. Matthew didn't even look up. Like German printing, the early days of English drama were a subject for later discussion. For the most part, Matthew's books were in pristine condition. This was not entirely surprising, given their owner. Some, though, were well worn. A slender, tall book on the bottom shelf, for instance, had corners so torn and thin you could see the wooden boards peeking through the leather. Curious to see what had made this book a favorite, I pulled it out and opened the pages. It was Vesalius's anatomy book from 1543, the first to depict dissected human bodies in exacting detail. Now hunting for fresh insights into Matthew, I sought out the next book to show signs of heavy use. This time it was a smaller, thicker volume. Inked into the foredge was the title De Motu, William Harvey's study of the circulation of the blood and his explanation of how the heart pumped must have been interesting reading for vampires when it was first published in the 1620s, though they must already have had some notion that this might be the case. Matthew's well-worn books included works on electricity, microscopy, and physiology, but the most battered book I'd seen yet was resting on the 19th century shelves, a first edition of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Sneaking a glance at Matthew, I pulled the book off the shelf with the stealth of a shoplifter. Its green cloth binding, with the title and author stamped in gold, was frayed with wear. Matthew had written his name in a beautiful copperplate script on the flyleaf. There was a letter folded inside. "Dear Sir," it began, "your letter of 15 October has reached me at last. I am mortified at my slow reply. I have for many years been collecting all the facts which I could in regards to the variation and origin of species, and your approval of my reasonings comes as welcome news, as my book will soon pass into the publisher's hands." It was signed C. Darwin, and the date was 1859. The two men had been exchanging letters just weeks prior to Origen's publication in November. The book's pages were covered with the vampire's notes in pencil and ink, leaving hardly an inch of blank paper. Three chapters were annotated even more heavily than the rest. They were the chapters on instinct, hybridism, and the affinities between the species. Like Harvey's treatise on the circulation of blood, Darwin's seventh chapter on natural instincts must have been page-turning reading for vampires. Matthew had underlined specific passages and written above and below the lines, as well as in the margins as he grew more excited by Darwin's ideas. Hence we may conclude that domestic instincts have been acquired and natural instincts have been lost partly by habit and partly by man selecting and accumulating, during successive generations, peculiar mental habits and actions, which at first appeared from what we must, in our ignorance, call an accident. Matthew's scribbled remarks included questions about which instincts might have been acquired and whether accidents were possible in nature. Can it be that we have maintained, as instincts, what humans have given up through accident and habit? He asked across the bottom margin. There was no need for me to ask who was included in we. He meant creatures. Not just vampires, but witches and demons, too. In the chapter on hybridism, Matthew's interest had been caught by the problems of crossbreeding and sterility. First crosses between forms sufficiently distinct to be ranked as species and their hybrids, Darwin wrote, are very generally but not universally sterile. A sketch of a family tree crowded the margins next to the underlined passage. There was a question mark where the roots belonged and four branches. Why has inbreeding not led to sterility or madness? Matthew wondered in the tree's trunk. At the top of the page he had written, "One species or four?" and "Comment sont faites les dios?" I traced the writing with my finger. This was my specialty, turning the scribbles of scientists into something sensible to everyone else. In his last note, Matthew had used a familiar technique to hide his thoughts. He'd written in a combination of French and Latin, and used an archaic abbreviation for demons for good measure, in which the consonants, save the first and last, had been replaced with lines over the vowels. That way, no one paging through his book would see the word demons and stop for a closer look. How are demons made? Matthew had wondered in 1859. He was still looking for the answer a century and a half later. When Darwin began discussing the affinities between species, Matthew's pen had been unable to stop racing across the page, making it nearly impossible to read the printed text. Against a passage explaining, "From the first dawn of life, all organic beings are found to resemble each other in descending degrees, so that they can be classed in groups under groups." Matthew had written, "Origins," in large black letters. A few lines down, another passage had been underlined twice. The existence of groups would have been of simple signification if one group had been exclusively fitted to inhabit the land and another the water. One to feed on flesh, another on vegetable matter, and so on. But the case is widely different in nature, for it is notorious how commonly members of even the same subgroup have different habits. Did Matthew believe that the vampire diet was a habit rather than a defining characteristic of the species? Reading on, I found the next clue. Finally, the several classes of facts which have been considered in this chapter seemed to me to proclaim so plainly that the innumerable species, genera, and families of organic beings with which this world is peopled have all descended, each within its own class or group, from common parents, and have all been modified in the course of descent. In the margins, Matthew had written, "common parents," and "ce qui explique tout." The vampire believed that monogenesis explained everything, or at least he had in 1859. Matthew thought it was possible that demons, humans, vampires, and witches shared common ancestors. Our considerable differences were matters of descent, habit, and selection. He had evaded me in his laboratory when I asked whether we were one species or four, but he couldn't do so in his library. Matthew remained fixated on his computer. Closing the covers of Aurora Consurgence to protect its pages, and abandoning my search for a more ordinary Bible, I carried his copy of Darwin to the fire and curled up on the sofa. I opened it, intending to try to make sense of the vampire based on the notes he'd made in his book. He was still a mystery to me, perhaps even more so here at Settur. Matthew in France was different from Matthew in England. He'd never lost himself in his work this way. Here, his shoulders weren't fiercely squared but relaxed, and he'd caught his lower lip in his slightly elongated sharp cuspid as he typed. It was a sign of concentration, as was the crease between his eyes. Matthew was oblivious to my attention, his fingers flying over the keys, clattering on the computer with a considerable amount of force. He must go through laptops at quite a rate, given their delicate plastic parts. He reached the end of a sentence, leaned back in his chair, and stretched. Then he yawned. I'd never seen him yawn before. Was his yawn, like his lowered shoulders, a sign of relaxation? The day after we'd first met, Matthew had told me that he liked to know his environment. Here, he knew every inch of the place. Every smell was familiar, as was every creature who roamed nearby. And then there was his relationship with his mother and Mart. They were a family, this odd assortment of vampires, and they had taken me in for Matthew's sake. I turned back to Darwin. But the bath, the warm fire, and the constant background noise of his clacking fingers lulled me to sleep. I woke up covered with a blanket, on the Origin of Species lying on the floor nearby, neatly closed with a slip of paper marking my place. I flushed. I'd been caught snooping. "Good evening," Matthew said from the sofa opposite. He slid a piece of paper into the book that he was reading and rested it on his knee. "Can I interest you in some wine?" Wine sounded very, very good. Yes, please. Matthew went to a small 18th-century table near the landing. There was a bottle with no label, the cork pulled and lying at its side. He poured two glasses and carried one to me before he sat down. I sniffed, anticipating his first question.
Raspberries and rocks.
For a witch, you're really quite good at this. Matthew nodded in approval.
What is it that I'm drinking? I asked, taking a sip. Is it ancient? Rare?
Matthew put his head back and laughed. Neither. It was probably put in the bottle about 5 months ago.
It's a local wine, from vineyards down the road. Nothing fancy, nothing special.
It may not have been fancy or special, but it was fresh and tasted woody and earthy, like the air around Settur.
I see that you gave up your search for a Bible in favor of something more scientific. Were you enjoying Darwin?
He asked mildly after watching me drink for a few moments.
Do you still believe that creatures and humans are descended from common parents? Is it really possible that the differences between us are merely racial?
He made a small sound of impatience.
I told you in the lab that I didn't know.
You were sure in 1859, and you thought that drinking blood might be simply a dietary habit, not a mark of differentiation.
Do you know how many scientific advances have taken place between Darwin's time and today? It's a scientist's prerogative to change his mind as new information comes to light.
He drank some wine and rested the glass against his knee, turning it this way and that so the firelight played on the liquid inside.
Besides, there's no longer much scientific evidence for human notions of racial distinctions. Modern research suggests that most ideas about race are nothing more than an outmoded human method for explaining easily observable differences between themselves and someone else.
The question of why you're here, how we're all here, really does consume you, I said slowly. I could see it on every page of Darwin's book.
Matthew studied his wine.
It's the only question worth asking.
His voice was soft, but his profile was stern, with its sharp lines and heavy brow. I wanted to smooth the lines and lift his features into a smile, but remained seated while the firelight danced over his white skin and dark hair.
Matthew picked up his book again, cradling it in one set of long fingers while his wine glass rested in the other. I stared at the fire as the light dimmed. When a clock on the desk struck 7, Matthew put down his book.
Should we join Isabeau in the salon before dinner?
Yes, I replied, squaring my shoulders slightly. But let me change first.
My wardrobe couldn't hold a candle to Isabeau's, but I didn't want Matthew to be completely ashamed of me. As ever, he looked ready for a boardroom or a Milan catwalk in a simple pair of black wool trousers and a fresh selection from his endless supply of sweaters. My recent close encounters with them had convinced me they were all cashmere, thick and luscious. Upstairs, I rooted through the items in my duffel bag and selected a gray pair of trousers and a sapphire blue sweater made out of finely spun wool, with a tight, funnel-shaped neck and bell-shaped sleeves. My hair had a wave in it thanks to my earlier bath and the fact that it had finished drying scrunched under my head on the sofa. With the minimum conditions of presentability met, I slid on my loafers and started down the stairs. Matthew's keen ears had picked up the sound of my movements, and he met me on the landing. When he saw me, his eyes lit up, and his smile was wide and slow.
"I like you in blue as much as I like you in black. You look beautiful," he murmured, kissing me formally on both cheeks.
The blood moved toward them as Matthew lifted my hair around my shoulders, the strands falling through his long white fingers.
"Now, don't let Isabeau get under your skin, no matter what she says."
"I'll try," I said with a little laugh, looking up at him uncertainly. When we reached the salon, Mart and Isabeau were already there. His mother was surrounded by newspapers written in every major European language, as well as one in Hebrew and another in Arabic. Mart, on the other hand, was reading a paperback murder mystery with a lurid cover, her black eyes darting over the lines of print with enviable speed.
"Good evening, Maman," Matthew said, moving to give Isabeau a kiss on each cold cheek.
Her nostrils flared as he moved his body from one side to the other,
her cold eyes fixed on mine angrily. I knew it had earned me such a black look. Matthew smelled like me.
"Come, girl,"
Mart said, patting the cushion next to her and shooting Matthew's mother a warning glance. Isabeau closed her eyes. When they opened again, the anger was gone, replaced by something like resignation.
"Gab es einen anderen Tod?"
Isabeau murmured to her son as Matthew picked up Die Welt and began scanning the headlines with a sound of disgust.
"Where?"
I asked. "Another bloodless corpse had been found." If Isabeau thought she was going to shut me out of the conversation with German, she'd better think again. "Munich," Matthew said, his face buried in the pages. "Christ, why doesn't someone do something about this?"
"We must be careful what we wish for, Matthew,"
Isabeau said. She changed the subject abruptly.
"How was your idea, Anna?"
Matthew peered warily at his mother over Die Welt's headlines.
"It was wonderful. Thank you for letting me ride Rakasa," I replied, sitting back next to Mart and forcing myself to meet Isabeau's eyes without blinking.
"She is too willful for my liking," she said, shifting her attention to her son,
who had the good sense to put his nose back in his paper.
"Fidat is much more biddable. As I get older, I find that quality admirable in horses."
In sons, too, I thought. Mart smiled encouragingly at me and got up to fuss at a sideboard. She carried a large goblet of wine to Isabeau and a much smaller one to me. Mart returned to the table and came back with another glass for Matthew. He sniffed it appreciatively.
"Thank you, Maman," he said, raising his glass in tribute.
It's not much,"
Isabeau said, taking a sip of the same wine.
"No, not much. Just one of my favorites. Thank you for remembering."
Matthew savored the wine's flavors before swallowing the liquid down.
"Are all vampires as fond of wine as you are?" I asked Matthew, smelling the peppery wine. "You drink it all the time, and you never get the slightest bit tipsy."
Matthew grinned. "Most vampires are much fonder of it. As for getting drunk, our family has always been known for its admirable restraint, hasn't it, Maman?" Isabeau gave a most unladylike snort.
"Occasionally, with respect to wine, perhaps."
"You should be a diplomat, Isabeau. You're very good with a quick non-answer," I said.
Matthew shouted with laughter.
"Gee, I never thought the day would come when my mother would be thought diplomatic, especially not with her tongue. Isabeau's always been much better with the diplomacy of the sword."
Mart snickered in agreement. Isabeau and I both looked indignant, which only made him shout again. The atmosphere at dinner was considerably warmer than it had been last night. Matthew sat at the head of the table, with Isabeau to his left and me at his right. Mart traveled incessantly from kitchen to fireside to table, sitting now and again to take a sip of wine and make small contributions to the conversation. Plates full of food came and went, everything from wild mushroom soup to quail to delicate slices of beef. I marveled aloud that someone who no longer ate cooked food could have such a deft hand with spices. Mart blushed and dimpled, swatting at Matthew when he tried to tell stories of her more spectacular culinary disasters.
"Do you remember the live pigeon pie?"
he chortled.
"No one ever explained that you had to keep the birds from eating for 24 hours before you baked it, or the inside would resemble a bird bath."
That earned him a sharp tap on the back of his skull.
"Matthew,"
Isabeau warned, wiping the tears from her eyes after a prolonged bout of laughter,
"you shouldn't bait Mart. You have had your share of disasters over the years, too."
"And I have seen them all,"
Mart pronounced, carrying over a salad. Her English got stronger by the hour, as she switched into the language whenever she talked in front of me. She returned to the sideboard and fetched a bowl of nuts, which she put between Matthew and Isabeau.
"When you flooded the castle with your idea for capturing water on the roof, for one,"
she said, ticking it off on her fingers.
"When you forgot to collect the taxes, too. It was spring, you were bored, so you got up one morning and went to Italy to make war. Your father had to beg forgiveness from the king on his knees. And then there was New York,"
she shouted triumphantly. The three vampires continued to swap reminiscences.
None of them talked about Isabeau's past, though. When something came up that touched on her, or Matthew's father, or his sister, the conversation slid gracefully away. I noticed the pattern and wondered about the reasons for it, but said nothing, content to let the evening develop as they wished it to, and strangely comforted to be part of a family again, even a family of vampires. After dinner, we returned to the salon, where the fire was larger and more impressive than before. The castle's chimneys were heating up with each log thrown into the grate. The fires burned hotter, and the room almost felt warm as a result. Matthew made sure that Isabeau was comfortable, getting her yet another glass of wine, and fiddled with a nearby stereo. Mart made me tea instead, thrusting the cup and saucer into my hands. "Drink," she instructed, her eyes attentive. Isabeau watched me drink too, and gave Mart a long look.
"It will help you sleep."
"Did you make this?" It tasted of herbs and flowers. Normally I didn't like herbal tea, but this one was fresh and slightly bitter.
"Yes,"
she answered, turning up her chin at Isabeau's stare.
"I have made it for a long time. My mother taught me. I will teach you as well."
The sound of dance music filled the room, lively and rhythmic. Matthew adjusted the position of the chairs by the fireplace, clearing a spot on the floor.
"Volest dansar en bu?" Matthew asked his mother, holding out both hands.
Isabeau's smile was radiant, transforming her lovely, cold features into something indescribably beautiful. "Ok," she said, putting her tiny hands into his. The two of them took their places in front of the fire, waiting for the next song to start. When Matthew and his mother began to dance, they made Astaire and Rogers look clumsy. Their bodies came together and drew apart, turned in circles away from each other and then dipped and turned. The slightest touch from Matthew sent Isabeau reeling, and the merest hint of an undulation or a hesitation from Isabeau caused a corresponding response in him. Isabeau dipped into a graceful curtsy, and Matthew swept into a bow at the precise moment the music drew to its close. "What was that?" I asked. "It started out as a tarantella," Matthew said, escorting his mother back to her chair. "But Maman never can stick to one dance. So there were elements of the volta in the middle, and we finished with a minuet, didn't we?" Isabeau nodded and reached up to pat him on the cheek.
"You always were a good dancer," she said proudly.
"Ah, but not as good as you. And certainly not as good as father was," Matthew said, settling her into her chair.
Isabeau's eyes darkened, and a heartbreaking look of sadness crossed her face. Matthew picked up her hand and brushed his lips across her knuckles. Isabeau managed a small smile in return.
"Now it's your turn," he said, coming to me.
"I don't like to dance, Matthew," I protested, holding up my hands to fend him off.
"I find that hard to believe," he said, taking my right hand in his left and drawing me close. "You contort your body into impossible shapes, skim across the water in a boat the width of a feather and ride like the wind. Dancing should be second nature."
The next song sounded like something that might have been popular in Parisian dance halls in the 1920s. Notes of trumpet and drum filled the room.
"Mathieu, be careful with her,"
Isabeau warned as he moved me across the floor. "She won't break, Maman." Matthew proceeded to dance, despite my best efforts to put my feet in his way at every opportunity. With his right hand at my waist, he gently steered me into the proper steps. I started to think about where my legs were in an effort to help the process along, but this only made things worse. My back stiffened, and Matthew clasped me tighter. "Relax," he murmured into my ear. "You're trying to lead. Your job is to follow." "Can't," I whispered back, gripping his shoulder as if he were a life preserver. Matthew spun us around again. "Yes, you can. Close your eyes, stop thinking about it, and let me do the rest." Inside the circle of his arms, it was easy to do what he instructed. Without the whirling shapes and colors of the room coming at me from all directions, I could relax and stop worrying that we were about to crash. Gradually, the movement of our bodies in the darkness became enjoyable. Soon it was possible for me to concentrate not on what I was doing, but on what his legs and arms were telling me he was about to do,
It felt like floating.
Mathieu?
Isabeau's voice held a note of caution.
Le chatoiement?
I know.